strategy fit in with a situation like that? Because I understand that it's a big place of pilgrimage for crows, or a lot of the literature that is being discussed and produced and represented there is not really compatible with the Bhakti Vedanta Book Trust publications. But I just wondered, nevertheless, how much of a representation we would ideally like to have there, or how it would fit in with our preaching strategy.
Nice question. And I say this not to... I'll go on to answer the question more fully, but initially I would just say that that type of thing, in terms of those types of fairs and that type of presentation, is essentially more, you know, at least it could be dealt with and handled much better by the BBT as opposed necessarily to directly ISKCON as such. So I informed actually Burma, because obviously London, within Europe, London is one of the major cities. So those types of fairs in a city like London, we should have representation at them. And whatever about what everyone else is presenting, it's kind of irrelevant. We should have representation there, and all of Srila Prabhupada's books should be available, both, as you say, in book form and also in digital form too. And I know that the DBT are very much working towards... we already know we have the Veda base. Vishnumurti Prabhu is doing this Vanipedia now, which is going to actually be a big improvement on the Veda base itself. We have the interactive Bhagavad Gita CD, you may have seen that like that. But all of that should be there at these high profile get togethers. Now, why the BBT weren't there doing it, I speculate that they simply didn't know about it. So I'll inform them. That's an annual?
It's an annual thing.
Yeah. What's it called again?
The London Book Fair.
The London Book Fair. International Book Fair. So I'll certainly inform them, because absolutely we should be represented there. The way that the BBT's relationship with ISKCON is, and it's the way Srila Prabhupada set it up, but it has a little bit of a little bit of a weakness, and that is that ISKCON is essentially 95% the customer of the BBT, even more maybe, that 95% may not even be high enough. And when you have a sort of monopolized customer like that, you can potentially become a little lazy in exploring other avenues for the distribution of Prabhupada's books, etc. Although, having said that, Brahm Mahurt is a very innovative and creative person, and you know, I'll definitely let him know about this International London Book Fair, and I presume it's around the same time every year, so probably in the month of May, and see what his reaction is to that. But nice question.
Calcutta was at one point the head of the colonies over there. They have a very big international book fair every year, and generally ISKCON Calcutta rents a booth. It's one of the most active, colorful booths. They get the BBT books and sell the books there, but they also, they get the donors' names. So they have a life membership, an Indian, I don't know what they call it now, but a development team there to spot out people that look like potential donors, and they usually collect more money doing that, but they also distribute the books. And then they also have a congregational booth there where they, people that look like they would be interested in putting the books to practice, they can sign up and so on. And one booth is a multifarious thing with sometimes, I haven't been there for a few, maybe 4 or 5 years. I used to go every year, but now it's not always there. But they also sell cakes and Krishna conscious prasadam, which is somehow you can pull all this up. I don't know if you can do that in the UK, but it's a very profitable. They invest a lot of money to make a very attractive fixed booth. And they also advertise tourists to Mayapur. So they're there in the book for because they're there, but they're, because there's about, I don't know how many, 60,000, 100,000 people go through to the book fair in Calcutta. And so they do it there. Probably if you told Shruti Dharma, the possibilities, or do it sometimes, join the fair.
Yeah.
I still understand what kind of people actually go there. Is it just an in-house kind of for book retailers book fair, or is it for the public? You know? In some parts of the world, I know that's how Gopal Krishna Maharaj, many years ago, he went from the DVT in Bombay and went to Moscow, to the Moscow book fair when it was the Soviet Union. And that's how we got a foot into the door, so to speak, in the Soviet Union at that time, for the book fair, but in a lot of contacts. But could be a DVT, or if ISKCON sees it's something that they can get a lot of preaching mileage from when they bring back the money they invest in the... Because it costs money to set up a booth.
It does
money,
yes.
Even in Calcutta it costs money. I can't imagine what it costs the money. Anyway, we don't want to...
Thanks for having me.
But the BBT could certainly finance that. ISKCON could man it, maybe. BBT could finance it and supply the books, etc., in the different presentations. I like the connection with Prashadam, by the way. It's amazing that Prashadam is it's just such a winner all the time. It transcends everything. It's incredible. Yeah, so.
Yeah, there was one guy, he must have obviously been with his book publishers, but he had a stall and he was doing a live cooking demonstration as part of his marketing kind of thing. In the middle of the book,
Well, that's one of our favorite books, is the cookbooks. So.
I was telling the devotee of the Maharaj yesterday and a few devotees that a couple of weeks ago, the Dutch Philharmonic Orchestra, the youth orchestra, from, I think they were aged from 16 to 25, and they were performing in Dublin. And it's quite interesting as well, and it must tell Rila Chaitanya Prabhu in Radovesh, because they're planning on opening a restaurant in Amsterdam soon. Which is a wonderful, every city is a wonderful city for having a governor's restaurant, but Amsterdam, of all cities, is definitely a wonderful city to have one. Anyway, the Dutch Philharmonic Orchestra were over, and there was 140 of them. And of the 140 of them, the girl, Anna was her name, she was sort of in charge, she told me that only 6 of them were not vegetarian. So that meant 134 of them were vegetarian. So they contacted me over the email to see if we could cater for them, which we could. We had to put them in the 3 restaurants because there was 140 of them. The day they arrived, the Dutch embassy actually rang me just to reconfirm, because they were so concerned that they would get there, that they'd get looked after nicely. So anyway, they came, and they came about 7:30 in the evening, and to one of the restaurants, they were in all 3, but in one of them, when they finished their meal, and they were leaving about 8:45 in the evening, they all just spontaneously stood up and gave the staff a standing ovation. They were so happy with being getting nice vegetarian food. It is the best meal they've ever had on the road in the whole of Europe, you know, was when they came. So Prashadam is just it's just such a good public relations kind of thing. I know you're doing me.
It's your restaurant, what do you mean?
But it's amazing, and Prashadam Prabhu was saying to me just a few moments ago, we were talking about different programs, and people asking questions and parashrams of that. You know, whenever someone asks a difficult question, just give them loads of prashadam. it's just a win-win, and we could literally just flood the country with prashadam distribution of all shapes and sizes all the time. You know, and as you know, a Hare Krishna festival is never complete without the distribution of prashadam.
Yes,
I know that. Devotees go to all the big pop festivals, like Glastonbury and the festival in Chelmsford, where there's about, you know, hundreds of thousands of people, and they distribute prashadam and vegetarian food stalls. So we're getting to a good crowd, mostly young people, I think, need spiritual enlightenment the most.
But young people also become old people, so it's good, you know?
Yeah, I know.
Badri Narayan grew from saying...
No, it's good publicity.
Wonderful.
It makes it, you know, gets the younger generation sort of familiar with us.
The devotee called Badri...
Especially as a big vegetarian, it's quite a big thing in this country now.
Oh, huge, yeah.
Yeah, huge. I think probably out of all the European countries, this is the most vegetarian.
Yeah, I think UK, Ireland and Holland lead the kind of way with the vegetarianism. It's interesting as well, the governments have now discovered, believe it or not, that the third biggest contributor to global warming, at least whatever, getting into the whole issue, but their conclusion now, the third biggest contributor to global warming is the meat industry. And apparently they're setting up strategies now to try to encourage people to actually become vegetarian, apparently. But there's this devotee in San Diego called Bhagavan Narayan, and he tells this story that they're building a new temple in San Diego, and it's going to be like in the Vedic design, nice Vedic design, the whole thing. And it's in quite a well-to-do part of San Diego, so there was a lot of local resistance. You know, it's in a kind of well-to-do part, so a lot of the wealthy people don't really like the idea of a Vedic temple appearing on their skyline. So they had to go through the whole planning procedure, and it was a long, drawn-out affair. And eventually, it came down to a final decision of one of the top guy in the planning department after many years. And as part of him making the decision, he was going to meet with the people who had the planning application in, i.e. the devotees, and he met with Bhagavan Narayan Prabhu. So the time came for the meeting, and Bhagavan Narayan went in, and he was all kind of nervous. This is the do-or-die kind of situation. And he went in as a devotee, and when he sat down, the guy started talking like this, and just chatting away in a kind of casual way. Bhagavan Narayan was still nervous about the whole thing, like, what's the decision going to be? And eventually plucked up the courage to actually ask him, so what about that? He said, don't worry about that, no problem, I'll pass that. He says, you guys fed me through university, in the university campus. He said, by the way, you don't happen to have any of those, you know those balls of there, I don't know, they're like fudge, they're really chewy, you don't have any of those. And by the way, did he have some of his car, so when that was parking back, he gave him the big man, passed the decision, and they got the decision to build a temple.
Mahaprasadam ki!
There's Swabhas Prabhu, who's the president of the LA community. Before he was president of the Denver Temple in North America. And those days before 9/11, was it called 9/11. Then we could actually do distribution of books in the airports of America. So he was going and supervising his book distributors, and he saw one man was giving a lady book to distributor a real hard time. Took the book and threw it down, said, this is all false things, I don't believe any of this. And then she came up and said, why are you giving this young lady such a hard time? So yeah, they're all, what they're giving you, they're cheating people. I don't believe in any of these things. He pulled out from his pocket a bliss bar, which in those days was made in New Barcelona, Colorado. He said, look it, this is a real thing. This is a real thing. Look at cashews and dates and raisins. I mean, this is real. Why don't they want something real? Not these false things like these books. And he said, sir, that's real? He said, yes. You know who makes that? It says here, New Barcelona. That's us. Because we study these books and it recommends eating a good, wholesome, sattvic, you know, food. Therefore, we produce these natural bars. Then your books must not be so bad. I take it back. So Prasad has a way of winning over people.
Everybody.
Definitely Pastor Ram is correct. He's been winning over a lot of hearts for many years. So, any other questions? We have books and prasadam.
My question is, we're of the understanding that the supreme form, the original form of God, is Krishna. And Krishna descended 5,000 years ago. What was the position when Ram descended 2 million years before him, Parasaram, Vamadev, Narsim, Varaha, Kurma, and Matsya? What was the position then in terms of the people? What were they to believe? As what is the original form of the Lord? How is it possible for them to have embraced the form of Krishna if he didn't actually manifest prior to 5,000 years ago? That's my question.
You, of course, mean manifest on this particular.
Yeah, manifest or descent. I mean, the form of Krishna wasn't necessarily known prior to 5,000 years ago. It was predicted, but it wasn't necessarily known to have existed or manifested. The two-armed form.
Yeah, of course, it's known throughout scripture.
Which scriptures?
Well, all scriptures.
I mean, the four are going to be Srimad Bhagavatam, Bhagavad Gita, Chaitanya Charitamrita, and Brahmasamhita.
Yeah, but scripture is eternal. I mean, the four,
I know, with respect, I know. Yeah. There are Upanishads, Puranas, Shiva Sutras, Veda, Siddhanta Sutra, etc. You know, these are other scriptures also eternal.
Yeah, I suppose I don't quite understand the question in the context of. I just don't quite understand what you're specifically asking. I mean, okay. The form of Krishna is eternal, is two-handed form,
yes.
And that's eternally known. It manifests here 5,000 years ago.
Yes.
And of course, Prabhupada talks oftentimes when these type of questions come up, because you said when Lord Ram manifests 2 million years ago. Prabhupada says these pastimes are eternally manifesting all the time somewhere within the universe, etc. And that we shouldn't try to analyze them from a chronological point of view.
Of course.
Like that. So, with that, and of course all these other forms that you mentioned are all eternal forms of Krishna too, and the Krishna, you know, fully incarnations of Krishna. So, if your question is that they wouldn't have had access, so to speak, to the form of Krishna, then that doesn't matter, because then worshipping these other fully incarnations of Krishna is perfect too.
Okay. And also, just to elaborate as well, the idea of the three aspects of the Supreme Absolute Truth. I just have a bit of a problem with the idea of the personal aspect taking precedence, because there's people perhaps in a remote area of the world, you know, they have no access to Murtis and so on, images and so on. What is their position then? I mean, what can they do in order to embrace God in any form at all? I mean, they're away from civilization. What can they do?
On the first question, that all of the many of the Vedas, the Puranas, the Upanishads do talk about Krishna. Even in the Rig Veda, which is considered as one of the original four Vedas, there's a verse that says, Om Voy Krishna Gana Krishna Adi Purusha Krishna Purushottamaha. That Krishna is the Adi Purusha, is the original person. That he's Satchidananda Gana, he is the quality of Satchidananda. So there in the Rig Veda it states, of course the Brahma Samhita was spoken when Brahma, in the very beginning of the creation, not this day of Brahma, which is already Brahma's 50 years old, but when he was just a baby, so to speak, just newly appeared, then he wrote the Brahma Samhita, they started saying it, when he had these different realizations. It was written down, and we got Lord Chaitanya found in the Adi Keshava temple. But there, of course, everyone knows the Ishvara Parama Krishna Satchidananda Vigrahana Adiyani Govinda Sarvakaranakaranam. That Supreme Personality God is known as Govinda Krishna. It's not like he's new, but whether when he appears, even if he didn't appear on this planet, that doesn't change his position. He comes every day of Brahma on the 28th Kali Yuga. So he's been here over 50 years. So 50 years times 12 months times 30 days, however many days. He's been that many times here in the universe. So the higher planetary people like the Rishis and Narada Muni and others, they know that Krishna is supreme. His original personality of Godhead. And then when it comes down to writing the scriptures for human beings, then it comes down to us in the form of Shastra, Shruti, Shriti. So, as far as the other second question, Srimad Bhagavatam states, Prameti Bhagavan, Prameti Paramatmiti Bhagavaniti Sabhyate, that the Absolute Truth is known in three forms. The Brahman, the Paramatma, and the Bhagavan form. So, some people go for the impersonal form, the gyanis, the yogis for the paramatma, and the devotees for the personality of Godhead. Obviously, all these things are out of the purview of people who are not connected to the disciplic successions. They have to be somehow connected to the disciplic successions to get the sadhu shastra guru, either scriptures or the disciplic successions or some great saints. And that's why in many of the contemporary dharmas, they don't always have a clear idea whether personality of Godhead is supreme or what is the form of the Lord. What Chaitanya was discussing with the Islamic gurus in the Chaitanya Charitamrita appears. One was a prince of the emperor in Delhi. And there he quoted the Quran, which means he gave respect to the Quran. And he said that in the Quran it said that absolute truth or Allah is impersonal. At the same time it said that he's also a person. And then I had one of my a fellow devotee who was from Azerbaijan, who was born in he's a PhD from an Islamic background, to search where are the surahs and ayats that support what Lord Chaitanya said, because we just have the English translation. That's a fairly new religion, only 1400 years old. But he found where it does say, like there's only one verse he found where it says Allah is impersonal, but mostly all the Mohammedans believe that he's impersonal, but there's so many verses that say that Allah is a person. So even if you have a scripture, it's so easy to misunderstand it. Jews, Christians, many Hindus. I had one life member come up to me. She was an elderly lady. She sat next to me. I'm your Islam life member. I just had one question to ask you. Why do you worship deities? When God is impersonal, then why do you have a form? I was like shocked when he was an elderly life patron. But so this misunderstanding is very prominent. That's why in our the Gaudiya, the Vaishnava Sampradayas, they're giving that the absolute truth is three forms. It's what the scripture says. Pramiti, Paramatmiti, Bhagavan, Iti, Savyati. The idea is that the Brahman is Sat, the Paramatma is Sat Chit, and the form of the personality of Godhead, Bhagavan, is Sat Chit Ananda, Vigraha. So, because Sat only is the eternal aspect, Sat Chit eternal and cognizance. But to get actually the Ananda, the blissful part, you need to have some personal loving exchanges. And that's why Krishna in his different forms have engaged in these different pastimes. And although we primarily read Srimad Bhagavatam, but I understand like the Brahma Vaivarta Purana and so many other Puranas have a lot about, they mention personally about Radharani. They give a lot more other details which are not necessarily in the Bhagavad Purana. The Bhagavad Purana for us is considered the most authoritative, but it's not that it's only mentioned there. Even in the Shiva Purana, Shiva says that the name of Ram is equal to 3,000 name of Vishnu, and that the name of Krishna is equal to 3,000 name of Vishnu. So there's a lot of different for the pandits. If you read the Shat Sandarbhas, which are now being published by the VDT and the Gopi Purana Janas, I think a couple of Sandarbhas already out. There's like 400,000 verses compiled by Jiva Goswami, and so he goes into a lot of depth quoting, scanning all the different Puranas, and it's amazing how he could do it without a computer.
Just to elaborate, I listened to a lot of commentaries from Prabhupada, I read a lot of the philosophy, many of his works. There seems to be more of a sway on the form of Krishna with respect. That's totally fine. He gave the example of a story where, Lord Shiva, by somehow, got into a predicament whereby a demon, if he touched anyone's head, he would destroy them. He obtained that boon from Lord Shiva, that whoever's head he touched, he would destroy them. And immediately as he actually acquired that boon, he reached his hand towards Lord Shiva, and Lord Shiva began to run away from him, escape from him, until he approached Bhagavan Krishna. And Krishna saved him in that regard. But then again, also in the Shiva Purana, there's another story also which shows that Lord Shiva can be considered superior to both Brahma and Vishnu. But Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, again, with respect to him, he didn't mention that sort of aspect. You know, such a very important... I mean, the story, I'm sure you may have heard, but the story where basically, Brahma and Vishnu were arguing who's better, who's the bigger. And finally, they approached Lord Shiva. Lord Shiva says, all right, whoever can find my feet, go search for my feet. Whoever can find my head, search for my head. So they both went in either direction. Brahma went up to look for his head, and Vishnu went down. He couldn't find Lord Shiva's feet. He could only find his calf. So he tied a cowbell around that calf, and that's why Lord Shiva has that cowbell around his calf. And then Brahma went up, and he couldn't find Shiva's head, but he saw a flower falling from above. And he spoke to the flower, he said, where did you come from? He goes, oh, I've only been falling for, I don't know how many days of Brahma, or how many, 4 lives of Brahma I've been falling for, you know, only. And if 4 lives of Brahma thought, okay, well, like that, if I die 4 times, I'll only be up to his ear. So he says, all right, he tells the flower, let's just say to Lord Shiva that we found his head. Lord Shiva knew that they didn't find his head. So he cursed the flower, he said, flower, you cannot be worshipped at my puja for Shivaratri anymore. And Brahma, you must not be worshipped. So you see, that is a perfect story where Shiva can be interpreted as being higher than Vishnu or Krishna. And this is the danger I feel, from my understanding, of worship and the personal. Even though I understand it's all one and the same, that it's equal regard to all religions and all forms of performance of Paramatma and everything. But that's the danger. You know what I mean? Like the danger of the Shiaites and the...
Well, you're not really asking a question, you're giving us a lecture.
Fair enough.
The point is that Bhaktivedanta Prabhupada said that there's 18 Puranas, 6 are in the mode of goodness, 6 in passion, 6 in ignorance, and that the different Puranas each take a different perspective. But the Bhagavad Purana is considered to be the Amala Purana, the purely transcendental Purana. So that's why we study primarily the Bhagavad Purana. And throughout the Puranas, even if you go, you'll find Shiva himself is saying Krishna is the Supreme. So we have some Puranas say things from a different perspective. Doesn't cancel out. But that's why we study the Bhagavad Purana, because we're told that if you try to read all the Puranas,
yes,
you're probably going to get confused.
Yes.
Because each one's coming from a different perspective.
I have to say though,
Let's give someone else a chance.
Yeah, no, this is just a
phrase. Give him a lot of Bashar.
I have to say, he wasn't for Prabhupada's teachings. I have to say, I would not have developed an interest. It was because of Prabhupada. You know, that I began to acquire. I don't necessarily agree with everything that he'd written, you know. However, if it weren't, I became the material.
That's the difference. Precisely. I'm his disciple, I agree with everything he wrote.
Excuse me, sir. We are not able to enjoy these discussions because we can't hear very well this side. Can have some mic. That's
not unfinished.
No, because it's going on and we are just sitting here.
What speaker there?
No. Just if you don't have, it's okay. Somebody can speak louder, but we are not able to enjoy.
Maybe I'll move over this side.
Okay.
I don't know. Where do you hear better?
Anyway, we've been asked for some other questions. It's a simple case. Nobody's here to try to convince you of whatever you do or don't accept or don't believe. It's all a question of who we accept as authority. And as Maharaj has outlined, we're accepting Srila Prabhupada as our authority. And for me personally, having been born in Western society, knowing nothing about the Vedas, Bhagavad Purana, etc., knowing nothing whatsoever, that when you receive this knowledge from a person who is so, the knowledge of one thing, very, very knowledgeable person, but it's the motivation of that person in disseminating that knowledge that, for me personally, for the safety of my own spiritual life, I have no interest in trying to, you use the phrase that, you know, some things I don't agree with. I personally would have no interest in disagreeing. Wherever that leads me in my spiritual life, I'm perfectly happy with that destination. And if there is something further to achieve in some future existence, which I'm not saying there is, by perfectly following the instructions of Srila Prabhupada, then fine. But for me, the protection is in following somebody who's vastly, I wouldn't have the interest to get into second-guessing what he does or did or didn't say, or what is written in the books. But having said that, Maharaj, I think, has given some nice answers also, that you'll see many, many references where Lord Shiva is fully accepting the authority and the position of Krishna like that. And Maharaj mentioned the Brahma Samhita, and the verse we have, Ajam Purana Purunam Navayoga Namcha, that Krishna is simultaneously the oldest, and he's also ever youthful and the youngest. So everything is contained within the personality of Krishna like that. And, you know, but if you want to accept some other authority, that's perfectly okay. It's not our position to try to convince you otherwise.
If we have it in writing, we can give it up in writing.
I'm working with my mentor about my Krishna consciousness, and the advice I've been given is just embrace my sadhana bhakti, with sadhana bhaktas, and all opportunities just embrace. So get your japa done, get your reading done, go to work, be with the parents, and just embrace the Krishna consciousness. One more question I would like to ask is, sometimes I get confused in, say, even when I go to work, is my main objective doing the work, the actual embracing of the action of the work, or is it the devotion behind it? Because and just to end there is, do I put more devotion into the work, or is my action of the work the devotion?
Ooh. Hare Krishna.
Are you all right, Mara Mara?
And I've asked, I've not got too much into it, but I'd like to ask your personalities as both of yourselves, just whatever advice you can give. Because I've been told, just get a nice, work out the balance between the action and the devotion. And this comes to all things, even writing things down, listening. Do I just, am I more listening or am I doing more devotion?
What work do you do? What's your job?
I'm sell loans, secured loans.
Well,
the question is regarding all types of embracing the 24-hour thing of Krishna consciousness, but work's just one of them.
But you use the connect. You're asking what level of devotion should you put into your work?
The devotion towards Krishna. Thinking of, because we think of Krishna while doing all activities.
Mm-hmm.
Am I more put my energy towards thinking of Krishna, or more towards the action of the sadhana that I've got to do? It's more of a sort of
the action of the sadhana that you've got to do.
Yeah. So if I've got certain sadhana to do, if I'm say, yeah, so giving, doing work, reading, chanting, just chanting, eating prasadam, even do I spend more of my energy into just nicely eating the prasadam, or do I put more time in the devotion of it?
But that is devotion. I mean, putting your thoughts and energy into, you know, honoring and respecting prasadam properly, eating it properly, etc. That is a devotional act. Specifically in relation to your work, selling loans, I wouldn't be inclined to use the word devotion at all. I mean, that's a job that you have. Everybody has to work in order to earn a certain amount of money so that they can keep body and soul together. But it's a means to an end. You know, selling loans, you know, isn't going to, in that sense, get you back to Godhead. But, you know, but then if you use the fruits of that work in the service of Krishna, then that's the perfection of that work. But I certainly wouldn't be inclined to sort of be meditating on it as being a Krishna conscious activity in and of itself. You know, and that's why ideally, of course this isn't a luxury that we all have, but ideally it's a wonderful thing if our livelihood can be generated through an activity that's also Krishna conscious, that it has a Krishna conscious connection. Selling loans doesn't, so therefore you just do it diligently so that you don't get sacked. You know, if you're going around meditating on Krishna's pastimes, you know, you might lose a few sales and then eventually your boss will get fed up with you and then you'll be on the dole. So in that sense, do it well enough so that you do the job properly, you have a contract, whatever you want of that. But then all the other things that are directly connected to your Krishna conscious lifestyle, then yes, that you should put full meditation on and full attention on this phrase and ekena manasa, that the devotee gives one point of attention to his devotional activities. Very important point, because if maya is so powerful and this material world is such a distraction, that it's very, very easy to get distracted into the wrong things all the time. But if you've got one focused attention, then you have a much, much better chance of not being distracted like that. That phrase that's used in the Bhagavatam when Sukadeva Goswami is speaking is that the sages are listening with rapt attention. These phrases that Srila Prabhupada uses are very, very descriptive. Rapt attention, it means full attention, that they're just absorbed. You know, there's no question of them being distracted, because what they're listening to is exactly what they want to hear, and they want to hear more and more and more of it like that. So yeah, for your devotional activities, whether it's chanting Hare Krishna, whether it's eating prasadam, all of those things, yeah, you should really try to put your full attention and focus on that in devotion to them. But when you're selling your loans, just, sell as many as you can, because then you make loads of money, and then you can also use the lecture in Krishna service.
You're going to answer this one? Yeah? Which one you answer?
I didn't see.
Okay.
What we're practicing is from Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, something I have for the, it's called Yukta Vairagya, which means that you don't renounce what you're doing, but you offer the results of what you're doing and the activity to Krishna. Now, as Kagosh Prabhu mentioned, there's some activities that directly, like say your service happened to be selling to Prabhupada's books, you were a pujari or something like that, well then your activity is directly in devotional service. But that's usually the people who are in a brahminical or some direct service with some temple, they might get that opportunity. But for most people, they do an occupation which the result is the income they get, either the profit or the salary, and they have to maintain themselves. Survival is authorized in the Srimad Bhagavatam as a bona fide purpose of doing something. You have to survive, otherwise you die. But if there's some profit from that, some surplus, then use that for some devotional service. Even how you survive, you offer your food to Krishna and Japa. So we set aside, under normal conditions, certain time for our sadhana bhakti, for our japa, for our pujas, for our reading. And then we have time that we set aside for our work, to survive, to maintain our family. And then beyond that, if there's more time, then we try to set some time apart for sadhu sangha, like having a retreat like this, like going to an amahata or bhakti riksha, visiting the temple, so that we get enough association with devotees that we're able to advance in our spiritual life. And the Upadesha Amrita, or Nectar of Instruction, Rupa Goswami gives six things which we should avoid, six things which we should do. So one of the things we should do or be is to be in good association. So you want to have some quality association time. Somehow how this affected the question you asked me, the house where I was staying last night, you asked me the same question. And very similar question at least. So we're bringing up how Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he was working as a magistrate. But that wasn't a particular he had to sentence people to life imprisonment or to being hung or being going to jail for whatever crimes they committed. Plus he had to do some executive work also at that time. They did both, executive and judicial. So he had his whole day planned out. That from 10 to 2, 10 to 1, he'd be working in the office, and then he'd take his lunch, and then he'd work again from 2 until 4. Then he would finish all his work early. He was really fast at his judicial work. And he was always, it wasn't that he was sloppy at it, he was just very expert. So whatever judgment he gave was never overturned by a high court. It was always sustained that he didn't make any legal mistakes. But then in the evening he set aside 2 hours to be with his family. He had sometimes in the week when he went out preaching and did some hot programs. He'd go to bed early, get up early, and do writing in the night, write songs and books. He'd chant his japa. Then he would be available for people at 6 in the morning. If anybody came to see him, he'd give the darshan. Otherwise, he would read books. Like that, his whole day was planned out. So if you can plan out your day so you have a balance, you do your job that you have to do according to the requirements. If you're self-employed, maybe you can adjust the times. If you're working in a day job, obviously you're going to have to submit to whatever rules they have. Nowadays, I have one disciple, 3 days a week she can do her work from her house through the internet. So, they have that facility now on some work. She's a project manager. Some days, if she can manage the project from her house, that's a lot of it. So there's different spokes, so you have to balance it out. So you get a good association, you get the time to study, everything, you put it into the overall plan and make that. Just like they tell you, you have to take a vacation. So probably devotee, when he takes his vacation, he's going to go to a different kind of vacation place. Maybe go on a pilgrimage to Vrindavan and Mayapur, or go to some festival like this kind of festival. You're fortunate because you're in the UK, and there's like 8-hour work days and 40-hour weeks. So, in India now, some of these IT professionals, they work 14 hours, 16 hours a day. The outsourcing and the downside is they really work these people like anything. And they ask me, when do we get time? All they can barely do is their japa. And they can hardly come to the temples except on the weekends. So, here it's a lot easier to balance things out than in many places.
Thank you, Maharaj.
Okay.
So there's a question here. Srila Prabhupada has written a large number of great voluminous books. His disciples have added many more. If one has to read only one book, which would you recommend? Of course, the obvious answer to that question is that you don't only have to read one book. you can read more and more books. I mean, we all usually live, three score and 10, which is 70 years. So in 70 years, we can certainly manage more than one book. But reading between the lines of the question, because it is a question that comes up from time to time. As devotees, ISKCON devotees, in answer to that previous person's question about Srila Prabhupada's unique position and our relationship with Srila Prabhupada, that we just have this unpayable debt of gratitude to Srila Prabhupada. We can never actually repay him what he's done for us by coming to the West and making available to us Krishna consciousness. As the gopis said to Lord Krishna, as Krishna said to the gopis, Mahaprayanam, I cannot repay you. I cannot repay you for what you've done. So in the same way, we can never really repay Srila Prabhupada. It's just the debt of gratitude. So Srila Prabhupada's book should always take precedence. Always take precedence. And then even if you are reading other books, that's fine, but you should actually schedule it in such a way that, you know, 75% of your reading time is still Srila Prabhupada's books like that. Very, very important. Very important that we don't get into a situation where we're reading so many other books, whether they be Iskand Vaishnavas or other books again, that's all that we're reading and we stop reading Srila Prabhupada's books. So from that point of view, to answer that question, I would say yes, that's a huge thing. Srila Prabhupada's book should always take precedent, but we should definitely read more than one book. And then in terms of the sequence, Prabhupada gave us that sequence himself. In terms of the main books that we should read Bhagavad Gita, then we should read Srimad Bhagavatam, and then we should read Chaitanya Charitamrita. That's the kind of order that Prabhupada gave. And we should read through them systematically, starting from the first canto and going straight through to all the other cantos like that. Who asked that question? Okay, thank you.
I'm first?
In the Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna calls Krishna Madhusudana, a slayer of the Madhu demon. Who is the Madhu demon? I don't remember reading about him in the Krishna book. It's interesting. The Madhu demon is mentioned in Srimad Bhagavatam, but in the great depth is mentioned in the Padma Purana. So Prabhupada once said, I was present with him in Vrindavan. He asked Satchinandan Das that he should translate the Padma Purana and the Vishnu Purana because he wanted to do the Satsandarbha. He said, your Sanskrit isn't good enough. This is more simple Sanskrit than the Padma Purana, Vishnu Purana. Do that first because we also need to have these books for our devotees. So, primarily we like to read the books based on the Vishnu perspective. But so it happened, I would read that, sometimes I would read the Padma Purana. Whenever you read scripture though, there's a balance between you read a scripture, then you have the sadhu, and then you have the guru. Someone may read a book somewhere and read something, get confused by it. Now, if they don't have a spiritual master, and they're just basing it on their own intelligence and their own discretion, then it's very easy to misunderstand something. It's just like in the Rameshwar Tirtha, they say that Lord Ram, he worshipped the Shiva Linga, therefore that proves that Shiva is greater than Vishnu. But when you ask the Guru, what does this mean? And you find that there's much more. And if you don't actually have the scripture there and read the whole thing, then that because Rama was playing the part of a perfect king, because Ravana had the benediction that he couldn't be killed by a demon, by a deva, by demon or by a deva. He didn't consider human beings to be strong enough to be worried about, and didn't think about animals. That's why he didn't have the boon like Hiranyakashipu, not by animal, not by human, not by deva, not by demon. So then he had the half lion, half man. So a Ram could come just as a man. And the other devas came as monkeys or bears, and they fought with because he didn't have any boon to be protected against them. So it said that because he was playing the part of the king, he was told he should worship Shiva. So kings worship all the devas, but they don't forget that they're part of Vishnu. So he worshipped Shiva. Then Shiva came out from the linga, came and he bowed down to Lord Ram. And he said, Master, why are you worshipping me? Because he knew that he was a Vishnu all the time. But sometimes people don't tell the whole story, they only tell one part of it. So anyway, the question here about Madhusudan. There's a demon called the Madhu demon. And he was one of the most powerful demons in the history. He had many different mystical powers. And he went with all the other demons and they attacked Indra. So at that time, Indra was being defeated by the Madhu demon, because what the Madhu demon did is he, first of all, he used all kinds of mystical powers, and that was even confusing the devas. Then what he did is he made all of the demons look like devas through his mystical power, so that the devas couldn't recognize who was the demon and who was a deva, because they all look like devas. So if you want to fight someone, it's important to be able to know who's the enemy and who's the friend. But everyone looked like a friend. But the demons, they could tell who was the deva and who was the demon. So then, here's a Ganesh and there's a Ganesh, and suddenly this Ganesh is attacking you, and you don't know why am I being attacked by Ganesh, because he was a demon in the disguise of a Ganesh. So it was very confusing, and then Indra went to Brahma and asked him, that, what can we do? I'm completely bewildered how to fight against this guy. He's turning everybody, looks like devas. Like devas are angels. So then Brahma invoked that Vishnu should come, prayed to Vishnu to come down and help the devas. So Krishna promises that he'll help people according to how they approach him. So because the demon don't approach him, they help. And the devas did. So he came down to help the devas. So then Lord Vishnu cast through his Sudarshan Chakra, which went above the whole battlefield, and when the effulgence from the Sudarshan Chakra came down, then all of the demons were revealed. It's like some kind of ultraviolet light. Then everybody gets revealed who's who, you know. And immediately the name of the son, this is a demon! So then they were fighting. And they were getting the upper hand again. But then, the general of the demons, of the devas rather, is Kartikeya, Morgan, Skanda. So then, the Madhu demon, he took the form of Lord Shiva. And so then Shiva is the father of Morgan, so how can he fight against his father? He can't understand why my father is attacking me. But then, you know, Vishnu... Actually, that Shiva came out and attacked Vishnu, that's what happened. And Kartikeya was watching. So, but Vishnu knew this wasn't actually Shiva, it was Madhu demon in the form of Shiva. So when Madhu demon threw his weapon at Vishnu, then Vishnu threw his weapon at the Madhu demon, who was in the form of Shiva. But before the weapon hit the Madhu demon, he left that body. He left the body so that, but it looked like Vishnu killed Shiva. But actually, he almost killed the Madhu demon, but the Madhu demon already left the body and took on a new body. So then, Morgan felt bad, you know, why did my father just got killed? Shiva got killed. And all of a sudden, his mother, Durga, comes out. But again, it wasn't Durga, it was the Madhu demon took the form of Durga. And she said, you killed my husband, and she throws weapons at Vishnu. But Vishnu knows this is not Durga. Durga doesn't attack Vishnu, but this is the Madhu demon in a form. So then he threw a weapon at Madhu demon in the form of Durga. And again, the Madhu demon, just before the weapon hit, he left the body, but it appeared that Vishnu had killed Durga. Then the Madhu demon entered in a subtle form into the mind of Morgan and told him, your mother and father were just killed by Vishnu. You should now attack Vishnu. See how complicated a demon this guy was. And so then Morgan, you know, he got affected by emotion. My mother and father were killed. That's what it looked like. So he was going to attack Vishnu, which would have meant then if he would also have been finished. Then Brahma came and told him, this is all Madhu's mystical powers on you. You look in Kailash, use your mystical power. Look in Kailash and see your mother and father are still there. They're not dead at all. This was all Madhu demon's tricks. So he looked in Kailash with his mystical power and saw that Shiva and Durga are there. You know, I got cheated by this Madhu. And then, so then that time, then Vishnu did finish off the Madhu. So Madhu was so very complicated and treacherous demon. That's why killer of Madhusudan means that removing all kinds of obstacles from spiritual life. His mother could do everything. And I wanted to just offer my obeisance to Prabhupada, Om Gyana Tanyananda Syam Ganam Jana Salakaya Chak Surumurikam Jaina Tasmai Sigave Nama Nama Vishnu Padaya Krishna Visaya Bhutale Simade Bhakti Vedanta Swami Janamane Namaste Saraswati Devi Varavani Pacharyane Nirisekshu Sumya Vali Pachati Desutaya Sri Krishna Mukhakuroti Bachan Mamulam Gayate Giring Akipata Mahan Bande Siguru Vivatayana Dharman Kamara Nishi Chaitanya Shwara. Madhu demon. So whatever Vishnu does, that's also because Krishna and Vishnu are not different. Therefore that Krishna is also going to be called by the same names.
Thank you, Maharaj. Demons, very tricky.
Watch out for the demons.
This is just a comment from this Prabhu here. He just says, Dear Pradosh, I just want to add to your statement about your debt to Srila Prabhupada. In my realization also, we who are born in India also cannot repay this debt to Prabhupada, who made available Krishna, Bhagavad Gita, and Srimad Bhagavatam. Even though we followed, because we followed only mundane piety and were not able to understand or value any of our Vedic literatures, though already in our hearts. Just like a frog cannot take or enjoy the honey from the lotus, although born and lives in the same lake, only a honeybee is able to enjoy the honey and give it to others. Yes, and I would just say, yes, I just didn't want to be presumptuous enough to suggest, you know, that all those born in Bharatvarsha are in the same. But it's true, none of us can repay. Any of us who have come to Krishna consciousness as a result of Srila Prabhupada, giving us this knowledge and this nectar, that yeah, it's just a huge debt. Of course, we can't repay, but the one thing that Prabhupada wanted us to do that would help us to repay, bring us on the way, was to give this to other people. And he particularly stressed that point in relation to those of Indian origin, that you have to give this culture to everybody else. There's that story where Srila Prabhupada, or where Yamuna Dasi, Srila Prabhupada's disciple, who was the great cook. I'm sketchy on the detail, but the point was that she didn't want the cookbooks distributed or the recipes distributed, or she didn't want to give cooking courses, I think. One or both of those things. And her logic was that, you know, we need to be the ones who have this knowledge and this information, so people have to come to us to get it. Whereas if we start giving it to everybody, then we won't be unique anymore, we won't have that. And Prabhupada laughed, you know, and says, no, that's not the process. The process is that we want every single person, living entity on the planet, to have this information and this knowledge, so that everybody has it, not that we contain it. And then he made a philosophical point. He said, if you don't share Krishna consciousness, in this case, recipes, whatever it may be, if you don't share Krishna consciousness, then envy will grow in your heart. And the way to remove envy from the heart is by constantly giving whatever valuable thing you have, and the most valuable thing is your Krishna consciousness, that you share that and give that to others like that. So that by doing that, we can help to repay that debt. And then the next question here was, I find it more convenient to listen to Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, etc. And to read online, is it?
No. To listen online.
To listen online. You find that easier than reading the books. And then you say, as being an ICT lecturer, is it still essential to read these scriptures? So to read the books, you mean? Well,
what does ICT mean?
Yeah, ICT.
Information communication technology.
Information communication technology. But being an ICT lecturer, well, you're not lecturing on Bhagavad Gita.
No. But the computers are around.
Yeah.
So it's the books. I don't carry it around everywhere.
I see. But it's easy. You have access. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I would say the simple answer to that question is whatever works for you. You know, whatever actually works. You know, what you click with and what you actually connect with. Just like, that's also connected to, like Krishna, for instance, he reciprocates for every single living entity. I think I mentioned here yesterday, when Krishna's entering Dwarka, when he's going back to Dwarka, he's entering Dwarka, all the different citizens are welcoming him and wanting to see him. And Prabhupada lists, you know, from the wonderful exalted Vaishnavas, and then he mentions like the chandlers and the prostitutes, etc. And Prabhupada's just making the point in the purport that everybody has an eternal relationship with Krishna, and we shouldn't look on the person's external body or even their work to judge them in connection to that relationship. But at the same time, just like Maharaj was giving the example of the Madhu demon, Krishna will reciprocate with the demons as well. He'll reciprocate with everybody. Everybody gets the relationship and the reciprocation that they desire to have with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. You know, so if you want to have that fighting rasa with Krishna, Krishna will reciprocate on that level. You know, so whatever it is you can get. So whatever works for you, that's what you should do. Some devotees will tell you that they can't. They don't feel like they're reading Prabhupada's books unless they have the book physically in their hand. But that doesn't mean that if you're reading on a computer screen that you're not reading Prabhupada. You are. If it works for you, you're able to do it all the way. Some devotees will tell me even that if they're writing something, they can't type it on a typewriter or a computer. They have to handwrite it. So that works for them, but it doesn't mean that we can't use a computer or whatever. So really, whatever actually works. If you're understanding and absorbing the information and acting on the information that you're reading, then if it's from a computer screen or a papyrus leaf or, you know, a book or whatever it may be, then that's fine.
There's an instruction that Prabhupada gave. Generally, he requested everyone to read his books. I don't think this makes any difference if you're reading the book online or if you're reading it in paper form, but reading. Then he said that if there was like housewives who were not able to find the time to read, that they could play the tapes, his lectures, in the kitchen while they were cooking. And that way, by hearing his lecture, that would also give them the knowledge.
Do you have more questions? More time for them?
I just have one question.
Go ahead.
It's a kind of a tricky question. Can we hear a pastime of Srila Prabhupada telling how he was writing Srimad Bhagavatam before he came to the West, Canto 1 and 2, bracket, how he was receiving Krishna's instructions? We know that Srila Prabhupada was instructed by his spiritual master to write the books in English language, that he was publishing Back to Godhead, and then he was started to translate the Srimad Bhagavatam. He was staying in the Radha Damodar temple, and he said that he was getting a lot of mercy from the Rupa Goswami. His room window overlooked the Samadhi of Rupa Goswami, and he translated and got published the first canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. He presented to the then Prime Minister of India, Lal Bahadur Shastri, and he was appreciated by Lal Bahadur Shastri. So these are the kind of pastimes we hear that when Prabhupada wrote the Srimad Bhagavatam when he was in Vrindavan. I don't know what else we can say about that. He got the instruction from his spiritual master, so that automatically included, to get from your guru, that's considered that Krishna is speaking to the guru. In fact, that's one reason why we need a spiritual master, so that he can give us instructions. It's very rare that people get a direct instruction from Krishna. But sometimes Prabhupada also got instructions in the sense that he had dreams where he was told by his guru also that now you should go to the Tiksanyas, you should go to the west, you should. So he had those type of instructions. But he directly, even before that, he got instruction where he told he was walking in the Radha Kunda, and he was telling, you know, that I built so many marble temples, and now the disciples are fighting over who gets which room in the temple, and I wish that I could pull out the marble, sell it, and just publish books. So if you get some money, please publish my books. So these type of pastimes we've heard many times about Srila Prabhupada being instructed by a spiritual master to publish books. That's why he made it such an important aspect of his life to publish the Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, Chaitanya Charitamrita. And instructed his disciples also to publish the Vaishnava literature.
In ISKCON New Delhi, there was a poster many years ago when it was news that Prabhupada was reading his own books, and someone asked that, why are you reading your own books? He said, I like them because Krishna wrote them. That's why it was written, that all these books were written by Krishna. He was telling him what to write. So I think Krishna was telling him what to write. That's why part of the poster which was in our temple.
I get caught up because here it said before he went to America, but that would also, Krishna was speaking through him and Guru was speaking through him. Good point. Thank you very much.
And just as it says in Bhagavad Gita, Tesham Satata Yuktanam, that if we have a sincere desire, Krishna will direct us. It may not even necessarily be that we always know that's happening. Because that is a very dangerous area to get into, that we think we're having some direct dialogue with the super soul, but it doesn't mean that the super soul isn't actually directing us, you know, in our daily activities if they're Krishna conscious like that, particularly if we have that sincere desire to actually do the right thing. That's the whole point. If we've got a sincere desire, it's free from personal motivation, then Krishna will guide us in doing the right thing, the right thing to do. Okay, I've just got to know, because we have a little procession this afternoon in Stratford City Centre, and I presume that's organised with the local authorities, so therefore we kind of have to go on time. We can't sort of mess. So that's at 3 o'clock, so I'm told that Prashadam is 5 minutes past 2. So try to be a little brief with these. Thanks for all the questions, by the way. All the questions are very, very nice. Some are a little trickier than others. Here's one. Paramatma is in every atom. Is there Jiva also in every atom? And if so, is atom considered to be one of the species from the 8,400,000 species? Okay, so Paramatma is in every atom. We understand the living entity is in every... You can tell that the living entity is in a particular body, whatever that body may be, if it goes through certain processes, i.e. that it's born, that it grows, that it produces byproducts, that it dwindles, that it dies, like that. But this is an interesting subject, quite philosophical subject, because every atom, what's actually meant by every single atom? Prabhupada often would give the example, simple example, that he would say, he'd be making the argument for the living entity is existing in a particular body, and he would say it would go through the six stages of life. But then he would bang the table, and he would say, just like there's no living entity in this table, this is dead matter, because it doesn't go through those processes. This table wasn't born, and the table won't grow, it will stay exactly as it is. And a table won't have baby tables, won't happen. So Prabhupada would say that this is dead matter. But then, is the table not made up of atoms? Like that, are there not atoms in the actual makeup of the table, etc.? So our understanding is that the super soul is in every atom, but then there will be different types of atoms, and that in Prabha's example, that simple example, we can understand there is no living entity in a harmonium, there's no living entity in a chair, there's no living entity in this microphone sound, because they don't go through those six stages of life. So, could get into that discussion more on that particular subject, but again, given the time restraints, I'm going to hand the mic over to Maharaj for the next question.
Harirom Tat Sat. In Bhagavad Gita, chapter 18, text 26, I know you all know it by heart, so I won't read it. It says, one who performs his duties without association with the modes of nature, without false ego, with great determination, enthusiasm, and without wavering in success or failure, is said to be a worker in the mode of goodness. The question is, if one is not in association with the modes of nature, how can he be in the mode of goodness? Krishna is describing the different kinds of work. There's the work in ignorance, where someone does it out of anger and out of madness. There's work in the mode of passion, where they do it for a profit. And here's a work in the mode of goodness. One is doing their duties because they know that it's the correct thing to do. And they have these qualities. So there are three modes of nature. There's the passion, ignorance, and there's goodness. So they're not doing for any mundane purpose. They're not doing it for ignorance and passion particularly, or even just for... That's particularly what's meant here. But in case sometimes people do things because... the duties are not associated with the material nature. They're not a duty that's based on some mundane purpose. Because if he does his work in this attitude, then it's considered in the mode of goodness. Prabhupada explained that we should try to be in the mode of goodness first. Come up to the mode of goodness, and then from there we can get to the transcendental level. So, what I mean from this is mainly, of course, this is referring to association with passion and ignorance. But it's not for any mundane purpose, they're just doing it because it's the duties. Without false ego, with great determination, enthusiasm, without wavering. When we do our we're trying to reach above the mode of goodness to the mode of sudasava, which is pure goodness. In which case then it is because you're doing something for Krishna. So ultimately, we're trying to go beyond even the mode of goodness, and do it, but we would have at least these qualities. But then it would be connected that directly we're doing it to satisfy Krishna. You're doing it as a devotional service, and then devotional service is above the three modes. Pamcha joga vicharina bhakti joga ena sevate sagunayam samatitai tandra mamuvaya nalpati. So that if we are performing our activities as a devotional service, then it's above the modes of nature, and it's on the Brahma Bhuvaya platform, it's on the absolute platform. That's what our ultimate goal is, but in trying to achieve that, this is how we would perform our work without connecting it to some material modes and without false ego. So the devotee is also very determined to do their service. Without this determination, it's not possible to be able to achieve some wonderful things. So this was spoken, of course, to Arjuna, and he was first of saying, if I win the battle, then I'll I don't want to have to win. I have to kill all my relatives. If I lose the battle, then anyway you lose the battle, you're going to be killed. And then Krishna explained that if you lose the battle, as a chapter you go to Swarga. And if you win, you'll be a great king. But he said the best thing to do is fight without thinking of winning or losing, but just fight because it's, I want it, because it's my service. So that's the transcendental level. So Krishna is explaining all the different levels. So he's explaining passion, he's explaining ignorance, he's explaining goodness. And he also tells Arjuna that the best thing is just fight for me, which is the transcendental purpose. But that's called Sudasattva. It's in the mode of pure goodness. And so that's even beyond the material goodness.
Yeah. Morality. There's relative morality, absolute morality, and then transcendental morality. And it is a real challenge for us as devotees. This next question, also, in my understanding, the purification manifests by becoming aware of our anarthas, but also when we go down, material desires start to manifest in our heart. How to distinguish between the two, progress and fall down? So, on this point about Sudasattva and the transcendental plane, it's a very, very high platform, very, very high level, and therefore there are many, many tests in order for us to enter into those kind of higher levels. This verse by Bhagavad Gita 3:30, what's the first line of that verse? Something. Bhagavad Gita. What's the first one? Mayi Sarvani Karmi. That's it. Mayi Sarvani Karmi. Sanyashat Machet Vandirs. Monirishir Bhutva Yugasva Bigatashwara. And read the English. Such a fantastic verse, you know, without any claim to proprietorship, without any desire for profit. So basically completely free from any personal motivation whatsoever, he's instructing Arjuna to carry out his order and go and fight. But not just go and fight, but do it enthusiastically, free from lethargy. This whole material world functions on the principle that people are getting something for what they do. You're talking about your work. You wouldn't go to your bank or wherever it is, mortgage broker that you work for, to make sales if they didn't pay you a salary at the end of the week. You just wouldn't go. Everything that functions in the material world functions on the basis that you're getting something in return. Yet Krishna consciousness is the exact polar opposite. And it's a very, very high platform to function, as in Bhagavad Gita 3:30. We know the story from the Mahabharata when Krishna instructs Yudhisthira to go and tell Dronachar to tell him that his son is dead, like that, because this will be devastating news to Dronachar, and this is how he'll actually be defeated. But Yudhisthira hesitates, because Yudhisthira didn't want to tell a lie, because he was a very moral person, didn't want to tell a lie, and simply because of that hesitation he had to seek help. And likewise Krishna, you know, the reason that Radharani was married to Abhimanyu is simply so is that because Abhimanyu didn't really consider himself the husband of Radharani in that sense, in a normal husband-wife relationship. The whole reason was that Krishna could have that parakeet relationship like that. So, you know, understanding these things and acting exclusively, there's another nice verse, exclusively on for the desire of Krishna and not for your own desire. Just exclusively for Krishna's pleasure and Krishna's desire. You know, we really have to be very, very sincere in our attempt to do that. There's this other wonderful verse in Bhagavad Gita, Etam Vibhutam Yogam Cha Mama Yogati Tatvataha Zohi Kalpena Yogena Yujyapta Matrasamshaya. And that says that That's 10.7, just to make sure I get the English right. That's Krishna saying to Arjuna, if you're accepting, if you're understanding, have you heard?
Shall I read it?
Yes, please.
The translation.
Yeah.
One who is factually convinced of this opulence and mystic power of mind engages in an analog devotional service. Of this there is no doubt.
So one who's factually convinced of this opulence and mystic power of mind. So, you know, Krishna, we understand, created this whole universe. Okay, this whole. And how did he do it? He just glanced. He just glanced over the material, just like that. Little glance, and all of this was created. Now that's pretty impressive. If you think in this society that we live in, how people are worshipped and glorified, you know, we're in Stratford. I think Stratford or somewhere near here is the holy dam for a certain person by the name of David Beckham. I think he's somewhere around this local area, isn't he? You know, now you could go into practically every bedroom of every teenager around the world, and probably 50% of them have pictures of him on their wall. Okay? Right? Very likely. He's a multi-million dollar industry. Now why? Because he can kick a football. Because he can kick a football, he's getting all this glorification and all this adoration. Now Krishna, he just did that and created all these unlimited universes like that. So Krishna's saying to Arjuna there in that verse, he's saying, if you're factually convinced of this opulence and mystic power of mine, of this brilliance of mine, if you're actually convinced of who I am, then you will engage in unalloyed devotional service. Of this there is no doubt. Unalloyed, there's another one of these words that Prabhupada used. Unalloyed means no contamination whatsoever. There's nothing. Ahoitakiya pratihata. It's uninterrupted and unmotivated. So if we're factually convinced of who Krishna is, and as devotees we should be, he's the Supreme Personality of Godhead, we would be engaged in unalloyed devotional service. Of this there is no doubt. So hands up all of those who are engaged in unalloyed devotional service.
Trying.
Thank you, Maris. That's a nice answer. Trying. Yes, we're trying to be engaged in unalloyed devotional service. But to the degree that we're not engaged in unalloyed devotional service, that means every second of our life, every second of our day is full pure devotional service. To the degree that we're not, we then have to be wary of this question that was asked about purification. In relation to Anarta's, yes, when we start cleaning the heart, Prabhupada gives that example, the dust comes out, it looks like it's more messy than it actually is. But the question is, how do we tell the difference between progress and fall down? Identifying an anarta is one thing, acting on it is another. If we act on it, then yes, we should understand that's falling down. But just identifying it, that's okay. And then we work towards removing it. And we should work very diligently on these things to work towards the nice pastime of the cleaning of the Vindicha temple, where Lord Chaitanya compares the cleaning of the temple to the cleaning of the heart. And just like when we have a temple and we have an altar, we always keep the altar very nice and clean for Krishna, because Krishna resides on the altar. So in the same way, Krishna is residing in our heart. So we should always keep our heart as clean as possible, because Krishna is actually resting there.
What do you want me to do? You've
got another question, and then we probably wrap up.
I have 2 minutes to answer the question. If I live in servant temple, how is it about worshipping personal deity? Is it okay, or deity are just for grihasthas and temple has the main deities on the altar? In Mayapur, Srila Prabhupada wanted everyone to worship the main temple deities. And he said that somebody is making an excuse that they can't come to worship Brahmamano because they're too busy worshipping their personal deities, or they have personal deities. And they can deposit their personal deities in an almira behind the main deity, and whatever worship is offered to the temple deity will be offered to their deity. So, if the temple management allows a temple devotee to do some simple worship, that's really something that he has to or she has to coordinate. But the primary focus in the temple is the main deities and the altar. And any other deity worship would be secondary to that. Some people do worship, but it should be at the sacrifice of the temple deities.
There's one more question for you, Maharaj, just you can answer them real quick. This question here, very nice question. It says, these days more and more people are concerned about the environment. The church in Rome, the Catholic Church, has introduced a new sin. Thou shalt not contaminate the environment. That's pretty good. Maybe they should also alter the thou shalt not kill to include the animals. But anyway, one, what is our position on the environment? Two, are we running any environmental programs? And three, do Vedic scriptures have answers to modern-day environmental problems? So the last question, three, does the Vedic scripture have answers to environmental problems? Yes, it does. It has the answer. First sloka of the Upanishad, Ishvarshami Vamsarvam, that everything belongs to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and we should only take what we need to keep body and soul together. We shouldn't take more than our quota. Prabhupada gives the example in the purport where he says, if a sack of grain falls off a lorry, a bird will come along and they will peck into it and just take what they can to eat and keep some in their beak for their babies maybe. But if a human being comes along, he'll open the boot of his car and he'll throw a little sack into the back of the car and drive off with it. So the principle of Ishvarshami Vamsarvam would be perfectly compatible with a good environment. In other words, we don't exploit. We shouldn't, as devotees, we shouldn't exploit. Prabhupada gives the example of the tap running. We should never leave taps running. Water is Krishna's energy. We should turn it off. You know, now here in the UK and other countries around the world, the local governments are bringing in water meters and they're charging people for every drop of water they use because water is a really essential commodity. But we know that as devotees, it's Krishna's energy and we shouldn't do it. That's why Prabhupada wanted to establish Varnashram rural communities, because of this dependence of our society on oil, and oil has to be taken out of the earth. And these oil wells are drilled down really, really, really very, very deep like that. Prabhupada is an example that if we have bullocks plowing the land, Mother Bhumi is liking that. It's like having somebody scratch your head. You know, Mother Bhumi's really liking that. you see the animals, the monkeys, and that they scratch each other and all this kind of stuff. It's an enjoyable thing. But drilling big, deep oil wells, that's painful to Mother Earth, you know. So the whole principle of Ishvarshami Vamsarvam actually answers the environmental problem. Well, to speak of the fact that we're all prasadatarians, which means that, we're not adding to the problem of global warming by the meat industry. So that's our position on the environment. That's how we do it. Are we running any environmental programs? Yes, we have Parashuram, does his, he's gone now, but he has his pedal, what they call in India, what they call rickshaws. The rickshaws delivering prasadam, Rob down the southwest, that's his pedal stuff. The new Mayapur temple, Dr. Marsh can confirm that it will have solar energy, water energy, there'll be many environmental features built into the new temple that's being built in Mayapur. And yeah, devotees are definitely very aware of the issue. And we should, another thing we did, myself and Marsh are involved in the Mayapur project, that we put a ban, I think that ban comes into place in the next few weeks. We put a ban on all plastic, non-biodegradable plates, cups, spoons being Iskon Mayapur cannot buy them anymore. You know, so they cannot buy non-biodegradable. So yeah, we're more and more aware. But all we really have to do is study Prabhupada's books, and we'll understand that devotees should be the best environmentalists.
You mean all three, or just one?
In my understanding, that purification manifests by becoming aware of our anarthas. But also when we go down, material desires start to manifest in our heart. How to distinguish between the two, progress or fall down? That's one thing, why we need to read is to be able to build up our knowledge of Krishna consciousness so that we can recognize what is Maya and what is not Maya. It shouldn't be, if we don't know, we should always be very clear, this is Krishna consciousness, this is, and then do what is Krishna consciousness and don't do what is If you don't know, then you should ask our spiritual master, is this Krishna conscious? Or Krishna's, you're getting an idea that I should do this. I should open a slaughterhouse, but it'll be done very humanely. Or, like, I don't think that's what Krishna wants. You know, you shouldn't do that. Maybe get some ideas, but you can consult with the spiritual master. And then this third question is that a disciple means giving his or her life and soul to the spiritual master's instructions, becoming a possession of the guru. Is this a good understanding? Is this attitude to be achieved or a condition for initiation? I remember I stepped on a nail once. The Prabhupada wrote to me and he said that you should take care of your body because you're given it in the service of Krishna. Your body belongs to Krishna. And so you should take care of it so that you can use it properly in Krishna's service. So Prabhupada was always stressing that we belong to Krishna. And the spiritual master is a representative of Krishna. He's guiding us on how to use our mind, our words, our deeds in Krishna's service. And we follow the Guru's instructions, but if somehow we feel that there is some contradiction in what the spiritual master is saying and what the scripture says, then very humbly we have a right to ask the spiritual master to clarify our doubt. And it's not that Prabhupada was stressing, it's not like a blind following or blind faith. It's done with full consciousness, and we always have a right to ask a question. But it should be in a challenging way, it should be in a respectful way, and it should be clarified. The guru, he's also has to, anything he tells the disciple to do has to be according to his spiritual master's instruction with the scriptures and the examples, or the example of great saints and devotees. So we should be able to have a fairly large amount of faith in the spiritual master's instructions. Otherwise, why would we want to take him as a spiritual master to begin with? But this level that, you know, we cannot ask any questions, and there's a limit to that, because you can ask a question, and if he can clarify your doubt, then you can go forward. But it's not that you have to have total blind faith to do everything and be a possession of the guru before you as a condition for initiation. Because you're possession of Krishna and guru is guiding you on behalf of Krishna and taking you back to Krishna. But it's not that technically he's the property of the guru. But in one sense, there's also a pastime course where Ramanujacharya, he asked a disciple who was blinded by Shivites to pray to Vardaraja deity that he has a possession which is incomplete. And if he asked the deity to complete that possession, then he would be grateful. So he prayed like that. Well, the deity frequently offered him benedictions. He was such a pure devotee. And then he asked for that. Then the incomplete possession of the guru was his body, and so that he got back the eyesight. Because in some senses it's used like that, but not, there's some caveats on that, there's some limitation on that, that it's supposed to be used in the service of Krishna according to the scriptures and the sadhus. So we always do have a right to ask a question of the spiritual master. That's part of the disciples. Really, just like Krishna said so many things to Arjuna, and every time he had a doubt, he asked a question. But it was very submissive. He said this, he said that. So I'm a little confused. What is really best? Devotional service or the worshipping the impersonal? Then Krishna clarified that worshipping me as a person is much better. Yoginam sarva yoginam api sarvesham atyatem antaratmana sadhuvan vajite jujam savayukta tamo mataha. That by those who worship me in my personal form, they're considered the greatest of yogis, the most intimately connected with me. They're constantly worshipping me with love and devotion. Just like Arjuna asks Krishna questions, we also have a right to ask questions of the Guru. We do have a Dhamma. But then, yes, we do. If he proves to us that what he's saying is correct, then we should follow his instructions. In that sense. But not just blindly, whatever he said. We should be able to substantiate that. Eradicate our doubts. So thank you all very much for your nice questions and for your association. And also here for the temple and the priests and Panditjis have been so friendly and so kind to us. And they said they're inspired by your presence. They're going to expand the temple, make it bigger, have a bigger dining area also. So they're going to have to come back sometime and use their enhanced facilities. I want to thank Abhinav for his accepting
his electricity.
Is electrical.
We're stuck for tulsi leaf, so nothing is.
If anybody is carrying a tulsi leaf in their pocket, it hasn't been offered yet. It's not the normal thing.
No, really.
Can we not offer to picture of Prabhupada without tulsi? Can we offer to a picture of Srila Prabhupada without tulsi?
Yeah. We can meditate on a picture of tulsi.
We can meditate on tulsi, but we have a right, that's right, it's late, we can't be gone.